Welcome to the Healthusiasm podcast, a panel discussion on behaviors, innovations, and trends in health and self-care. My name is Christophe Choquet. I'm the author of the book called Healthusiasm and a global keynote speaker on the future of health and self-care business. Every month, I discuss with a panel of experts the positive changes that are shaping our health and happiness. And today, we have three of your beloved experts in the panel. Calling in from Barcelona is our digital health connector, Aline Noiset.
Hola.
From London, customer experience and research expert, Krupa Suter.
Hi, everybody.
And last but not least, from Ghent, Belgium, human experience expert, Mo Zumina.
Hi there.
And this means that we are missing out on our American in Paris, our medical expert in digital health, Aditi Joshi. In that case, we always invite a special guest to our panel, some new blood, some other expertise. And today's guest is an experience engineer and a well-being intelligence expert who authored numerous industry reports, specialist books, and publications. He is one of the very few people in the world who has been active in every aspect and domain of the health, well-being, and travel spectrum, such as medical and wellness tourism, well-being and hospitality, spas and leisure experience. So I think that with all that experience and wellness, our guest must be the most relaxed guy we'll ever have on the show. Welcome, Laszlo Puczko.
Thank you, and hello, everyone.
Hello, Laszlo. Welcome. Together, we want to amplify the health enthusiasm that we see in articles, new business ventures, or simply even in the world around us. Now, if you're new to the show, you might wonder what health enthusiasm is all about. Well, health enthusiasm is the aspiration that we all have to be healthy and happy. And as a result of this, every company or organization is now more than ever focused on making their customers healthier and happier. So tell me, Mo, what health enthusiasm did you witness in the past month?
Well, we've been talking, microbiome has been a kind of a recurrent subject in the podcast, and I've also worked for a microbiome startup called S-Biomedic. It's interesting because it kind of merges two things we already discussed, the digital twins and microbiome. So I'm very enthusiastic about the fact that scientists have invented what they call the first vagina on a chip. So it's scientists at Harvard Wyss Institute that have developed the first vagina on a chip, a small device, and it contains live human cells, and it kind of replicates the cellular environment found inside the vaginal canal. Now, by adding these bacteria to the device, they call it the vagina chip, they can study how different microbiomes affect the health of the vagina. And what's also interesting is, with the startup, the non-for-profit that we started, we've also funded research on vaginal health. So I think it's really interesting how they can really reproduce that environment using technology and making sure that we have a better basis to see how the microbiome reacts and how the different strains react in that environment. It kind of outperforms what we're doing with mice for the moment. So it's really an opportunity to bring women's health into the modern time using modern technology. And organ on a chip technology does have its limitations. So it cannot perfectly capture all the features that influence the human vaginal microbiome, but it's a good first step towards further research.
Lovely. I didn't see that one coming. Vagina on a chip. Maybe in the same kind of sphere of maybe confusing words combined together. Does anybody know what digital lavender is? I see everybody saying no. Well, it's some sort of purple color. And according to WGSN Trend Forecasting Agency, it's the color of the year 2023. Now, why do I bring this up? It's because that colors that are trending are in some way a representation of the sign of time. And digital lavender is showing just that, because it's a gender neutral color, but it also represents wellness and digital escapism. And research even showed that this type of color, which apparently has shorter wavelength, actually radiates stability and balance and evokes calmness and serenity. By the way, saying the word calmness, digital lavender, if you want to know how it looks like, it's actually a color that comes close to the blue that is used by meditation app Calm, but it's a little bit more purple-ish. And so it is said that the sensorial quality of this color, digital lavender, makes it ideal for self-care rituals, healing practices, and wellness products. And so therefore, it's even expected to be used in consumer electronics, digitized wellness, mood boosting lighting, appliances at home, all those kind of things. And probably also in many different wellness experiences. Laszlo, as a wellness and well-being expert, have you heard about digital lavender?
Not the digital lavender as such, but the color itself has been used for quite some time in anything to do with holism and spirituality. So that's a typical color associated with mindfulness activities. Let's say the most appropriate could be the most straightforward, could be anything to do with yoga is often associated with that color. But I think it's a little bit misleading, if you ask me, digital lavender, because lavender is known and used for its scents and the essential oil content and not necessarily the color of it. So I find it potentially a little bit misleading and even letting down anyone, because lavender's impact on your physiology as well on your mental state is coming from the scent and the oil, not necessarily from the color, or not only from the color. And then you have to create a digital scent of digital lavender. So that would be the completion of the full circle. But
I think that's why I like it, I guess, because it's kind of like saying that this color could do potentially the same thing as lavender, I guess, in a way. But so tell me, what is your enthusiasm this month? Did you see anything that you want to share with us?
I think this is everything that Mo said, for example, and we discussed it earlier. The being aware of what's happening with your body, especially physically or in your vital state or even your mental state, I think we need to be very careful about the information overload and to create a panic mode, because we can be easily bombarded with that much information of daily readings and data that can go beyond the healthy alertness and can create even paranoia, that you become worried about so many things and you didn't even think about it. And the more you know, you recognize how little you know and you want to know more. And then it's a spiraling into a situation that you are endlessly looking at data about your physical being, none of which probably makes too much sense to you because you're not a healthcare professional as such. And you don't have a degree in, 12 different healthcare specialties. And I think that's very critical now, that all those readings would have a meaning to it, because not the reading that counts, but what it means to you as a person, not average what the reading should be, but what it means to you as a person, and provide any kind of digital support to translate that meaning and say, calm down, nothing wrong with you. And it alerts you only if it really is something that you should be worried about instead of just checking it.
Yeah, I think if you're totally right. I write about this in my book. I call this healthy mania. I think the quest to be as healthy as possible can make us very unhealthy, even unhappy. So it's something that we need to be wary of. And I think you, as an experienced engineer in the well-being and wellness industry, maybe you should really reflect upon what is the experience that you can create around that to make sure that there is some wellness and well-being towards dealing with your own health as well, I guess. But I think information could be interesting as long as you don't go too far in it. And I think there was an article that you, Aline, can bring up, which allows us to even have more information. It was about Nico Health, right?
Exactly, yeah. So Nico Health is something, the new venture from Daniel Ek from Spotify. We mentioned it in previous episode. And a few days ago, there was an article from Sifted, where one of the journalists at Sifted actually tested the solution. She went there and I thought it was very, very insightful. So she said it's like a very, very discreet place and not even the name on the door. The session lasts for like 1 hour in total. So you get into that room, there's a full body scanner. So you start with that and they will do like 2,000 pictures of yourself in 2D and 3D. And then you lay down on the table and they will do more tests like ECG. They will check how your blood is circulating, etc. So after that, you get dressed again. You come back in the room and all the tests are ready already. So if you think it's 1 hour total and they manage to get the blood test back, they show you the images and they give you a summary of what's going on with you. And if you need follow-up, if something is wrong, they can recommend you to someone. And something that I find interesting is that they're actually using the data collected for different clinical studies. So there's like one on skin conditions, for instance, there's another one on heart disease risk, So I think that's great to advance. So their positioning is like they're really focusing on the future of the patient. They really want to revolutionize preventive care. And if you think about it, like when they publicized the appointments, they all went away in 2 hours and they've got 5,000 people on waiting list. And it will take them like 2 years to slot those people. So I think it's very interesting. So they received some criticism already, as we can imagine, saying that they're actually focusing on something that's not the problem already. But yeah, I think it's very interesting. So they are in Stockholm at the moment. They have one clinic. They want to expand in more, maybe more countries, more cities, etc. So yeah, it will be interesting to see the development of Neko Health.
Yeah, I love it. Talked about it earlier as well. And I think one of the major things here and what I'm really looking at with Neko Health is the experience that they're providing. Because healthcare is not typically known for having a good experience or providing a good experience. And this might be different. So I'm curious to see how they can maintain, how they can adapt, and what others can learn from it. Talking about experience, I came across a study by Rock Health. It was their 2022 Digital Health Consumer Adoption Survey. And the study revealed that telemedicine in the US has officially reached 80% of adoption. 80% of adoption. And it is said to have become the preferred care channel for prescription refills and minor illnesses. So this is what I really like, because I really understood in what cases telemedicine might be very valuable. And again, we're talking experience, and I think that is exactly what this brings. I really like that study. Another study that I saw that I want to share with you as well was done in the UK, Krupa. It was the world's largest 4-day work week trial. It was done in collaboration with Cambridge University. And it has been concluded, and the organizers behind it say that companies who participated in the study reported an increased revenue and decreased resignations, which is amazing. And about 92% of the companies participated will continue the shortened week. 32% already said that they confirmed the policy change is permanent. And so going back to Healthusiasm part of it, the trial also showed improvements in the well-being of employees. I mean, there were quite some well-being elements measured, like stress, burnout, fatigue, exercise, mental health, physical health, and all, and amongst many others. And apparently on most of these elements, it was really interesting enough to continue this 4-day work week. Krupa, to the UK. What have you read? What have you seen? What health systems have you seen this month?
Thanks, Christoph. I have seen that. It's really amazing. And it follows from other countries that have been successful in the 4-day week. So it's fascinating. I think I'm going to lead on from what Aline was talking on just earlier around preventative healthcare, and go to my first Healthusiasm. And that's a collaboration between University of Imperial College London, UCL, Birmingham Uni, and Cancer Research UK. And what they did is they collaborated with two high street retailers to obtain the shopper data of women. They had in total just under 300 women participating who shared their shopper data going back 6 years. And what they concluded was that the 153 women who were diagnosed with cancer, there was a notable increase in their purchases of pain and indigestion medicines, and which led subsequently to their diagnosis of ovarian cancer. And that pattern was seen 8 months in the lead up to their diagnosis. And that was compared with the 120 women that were not. So this is just a fantastic example. I talk about it with women in data as well through the work that we're doing, but it just shows how shopper data can be used for good. And ultimately, by sharing, if you do get the correct permissions, you could be leading towards preventative healthcare or having a very early diagnosis to lead to better health outcomes. So that's my first Healthusiasm. And then the second one relates around National HIV Testing Week. So earlier this month, there was a trial in the UK, and there's currently just under 4,500 people in England living with undiagnosed HIV. And what happened was that some people were sent HIV tests at home. What we've seen here is that there's been a drop in testing amongst heterosexual men before and after the pandemic. There's also been a drop in testing amongst women, although testing amongst gay and bisexual men has actually increased. But these test kits were sent to their homes. They were completely in plain packaging, so nobody will ever know that they had them. And what it entailed was a finger prick with results in 15 minutes. And then, if they needed, they would have a follow-up clinic appointment. It also collided with a really popular television series also talking about HIV as well. And it's just a fascinating way to show how testing at home can also increase people going to then actually hopefully not get a diagnosis, but also just increasing the uptake. And this was a really lovely piece of work from which collided with National HIV Testing Week.
Oh, lovely. I like it. Just coming back on your shopping behaviors, I think there's a lot you can do about shopping. And I recently came across two examples as well in the shopping area. Two US-based solutions for food inequality. And I know you like this example, Krupa. First of all, there's this company called About Fresh. It's a Boston-based nonprofit organization who believes that better food accessibility has the power to improve health outcomes. Kind of makes sense, right? But what they did now is the organization launched a Fresh Connect, which is a card, a debit card, that provides people of underprivileged communities with access to better and healthier foods. So here how it works. You meet with a medical and the healthcare team will define a monthly budget for you for healthy foods. And then people will receive the credit card or the debit card at home with money on it that allows them to buy healthy foods. So a really lovely initiative. Another one was Free for Market, also recently in the news because they have a new investor. If you're not familiar with Free for Market, it's an online platform that wants to make it easier for low-income patients with chronic health conditions to manage their health with proper nutrition. So again, shopping and helping the underprivileged communities. It's a bit similar to About Fresh, but in this case, it's an online store with a lot of products online. And they also provide one-to-one coaching, online educational resources, and so forth. It's really a health enthusiasm world indeed. I mean, if you look at it, there's so many positive changes that are making our world a little healthier and happier every day. I really enjoy watching these changes unfold. I analyze them and try to understand the broader impact of these changes. I even write a newsletter about it called It's a Health Enthusiasm World. If you're interested, go and discover them on healthenthusiasm.com. Now, every month during the Health Enthusiasm podcast, I'll recap one particular newsletter for the panel to debate. And this week's newsletter is Transformative Travel. Let's get into it. So when we're thinking of the most innovative industries, the travel industry may not immediately come to mind. But the travel industry has always been one of the most innovative in the way that it provides value for its customers. Think about it. Travel used to be mainly about renting a place to get out of the house about 80 to 100 years ago. Already in the 1960s, people wanted more. Travel companies like Club Med invented the all-in formulas. The focus switched from renting a place to stay to receiving endless services during your stay. Then in the 1990s, another shift occurred, as people were more keen on experiencing new things. Holidays were increasingly focused on, for example, things like whiskey tasting tours in the Scottish countryside, horseback riding in the Ardèche, or hiking in Iceland. But what the travel industry did here was something that was followed by many other industries in the years after. It was shifting from offering a product to offering a service to providing and selling customer experience. I believe that the travel industry was actually one of the first industries to create value by selling experiences. Now, in the past decade, we've seen the travel industry innovate value creation again, now focusing on what I call customer transformations. It's no longer just about organizing a tremendous or an enjoyable experience anymore. Instead, tourists, they look for travel that makes them feel better, healthier, or happier. The purpose of travel is no longer just about getting away. It's about coming back home and feeling transformed. And we see the shift happening in multiple ways. But I mainly want to attract the attention to the growing popularity of two things, wellness travel and medical tourism. And here's a number for you. Did you know that wellness travel already takes up about 20% of the travel expenditures today? And it's bound to grow massively in the years to come, because about 50% of travelers say that travel is the best way to improve your well-being. So what we see is that many people primarily would travel to wellness centers, such as like dedicated retreats or, you know, wellness resorts. And this type of travel takes up about 40% of the wellness travel today. But the remaining 86%, so the bulk of wellness travel, comes from wellness activities that are being incorporated in otherwise standard trips. After all, to the healthusiasm trend, or in other words, the increased emphasis on health, people are looking for ways to continue taking better care of themselves when they travel. And this makes sense, right? How nice and rewarding is it to add some health and self-care to your travel? But how amazing could it be if we do the opposite as well, adding some travel to your health and self-care? And this is what we call then medical tourism. Medical tourism, it might have been known and it's long been considered as the travel you have to do to be able to access affordable healthcare in another country. But basically, that definition is no longer correct. In fact, the main reason for medical travel today is the search for the most advanced technology or the search for a better experience when you have to undergo a necessary procedure. If you're working in healthcare, think about that. People increasingly travel for medical treatment to have a better healthcare experience. I said it at the beginning, travel is no longer just about getting away. Instead, it's about coming back transformed. Krupa, I know you've planned a nice trip very soon. I think it's also a bit to do a bit of self-care, right?
Yeah, it is. So I would be in your wellness travel section of this, which is we are trying to plan a trip to Bali, and that's purely for yoga and just to enjoy the spirituality whilst we're there. I wouldn't say this is something that's quite new. People of my culture, we go to India to Ayurvedic retreats. We've been doing it for thousands and thousands of years now. So I wouldn't say it's something that I would see that was particularly new. And also, because I've worked for a major airline in the past, they've offered treatments on board to certain customers that may travel in their upper class cabins, for example. So they're able to get massages on board or manicures or pedicures or whatever they wish, or in the spa lounges that they have at the airport, they've got, you know, full access to a spa. So I wouldn't say it's something new. It's amazing that if people wish to do that, that's brilliant. I think the medical tourism is something I've seen growing more and more. Traveling, yes, for advanced treatment, for sure. But if we take the example of, I've talked about this in the past, of IVF, for example, particularly in the UK, there was a study very recently by Fertility Network UK, and it showed that 93% of their respondents would consider traveling abroad. The majority of those people will travel abroad for treatment because in the UK, we have something known as the NHS postcode lottery. So depending on where you live in the UK, that determines your access to fertility treatment. And it also depends on your age and also if you have previous children and also certain medical conditions. So some people or couples or individuals will be offered up to 3 rounds of IVF treatment, and some may not be offered anything at all. So, and then if you look at the cost of having to pay, you could be paying anywhere between £5,000 to £20,000 per round of treatment. Whereas going abroad to other countries, you're offered that at, say, €3,000, and you have a holiday out of it. I wouldn't class IVF as a holiday, though, but you would have access to, you are not going to be in your normal routine. So medical tourism is something, is definitely I'm familiar with and have seen it through a lot of friends and family. But yeah, I hopefully this year I will travel for some wellness travel if I can. Yeah, fascinating.
I can only wish it to you, definitely. But indeed, it's nothing new. And I probably think that Laszlo will agree with this statement as well.
I absolutely do, and absolutely agree with that, and especially that none of this, what you mentioned, Christoph, can be justified by data, because statistical offices have a tendency of collecting data by first motivation or primary motivation of guests, or they do exit surveys, and many of those countries wouldn't collect data about medical treatments or wellness treatments. So most of the data that's been quoted left, right, and center has very little justification or grounds. We have seen it in many studies and many works that you can challenge this data very easily because, well, tell me where you get the data from, and then you find it very, very slim, the real justification of it. But certainly, traveling for any kind of health purpose, that's nothing new from Delphoi, from the ancient Greek times and also on. That's people have been doing it and taking the waters and going to climatic resorts and after the Industrial Revolution and visiting historic thermal towns. I mean, what's new in those? But I think you mentioned in terms of transformation and transformative nature of it, and especially in the medical side, some of those medical trips are done because you feel the need to do it, but you shouldn't necessarily have to. Especially plastic surgery, dental work, hair implant, those things, your voluntary decision because you're not happy with yourself or you want to look a little bit different. Therefore, you look for a solution and it will be very price dependent. And when Krupa, you mentioned the IVF, if your clinic can prove and there is evidence that your success rate is around 90%, people will come to your place from all around the world because all they want is the hope, not the wellness of it, the hope that they will feel complete. And the number one thing that will decide should or should not come to your place is the success rate. All the rest is secondary. Price doesn't matter. Location almost irrelevant. Is that can you prove me or can you assure me that around 90% of the treatments would be successful, so I would be blessed with a child? And that's what you care about. All the rest is no one cares. And really, when you have cancer treatment and people travel because they really want to have the best potential, best opportunity to survive and to live, they take on all sorts of treatments, none of which actually never been approved or never even be properly tested or certified. They go to countries where they believe that treatment which they Googled would provide the necessary outcome and result, and they are desperate and they want to survive. So they take on anything and everything. So the lawmakers and policymakers are really running behind of what the internet can do. And people really say they don't really care about anything else. They want to take treatments on international waters. They, on a cruise, inverted commas, cruise, and they do an IVF treatment on international waters. And because that wouldn't be permitted or whatever other treatment, I can mention a couple of those, that they cannot take at home because it's illegal, but they go somewhere else and they take it. And everything is fine as long as it's not fine. So you have repercussions, then somebody needs to pick up the pieces. And that's what we certainly can't do in international legal situations.
So I understand, I mean, there's a lot of health washing out there, as we call it. I also understand that many of the numbers might not be 100% correct or falsified or wrongly questioned. But you've been active in the industry for 25 years. What you must have seen a shift in the last 25 years, something, a positive change. If so, what would that then be?
I think the awareness and the interest in talking about customers, travelers as such, that they are happy to explore what's available, especially there is some evidence behind it, or there's some heritage relevance, or some lifestyle patterns that people have been doing, and therefore you want to be acquainted with that activity to see if that has the same impact on you. All these international measures, such as the happiness indices, the world happiness reports and well-being studies and quality of life studies and all that, really highlighting that then that you can do something. So I think that's critical here, that you need to understand your role in all this, that it doesn't just happen. Blue zones and the Hygge and the Lagom and the various other happiness systems in all that many different countries, I think the impact is now that people are more aware of options, and that's
okay.
Great.
Okay, Mo, what's your thought on this?
Well, it's really fascinating, but I think in the case of Krupa, for instance, getting IVF and having a holiday, it's both beneficial to the outcome. Because I think, you know, reducing stress, I think if you look at the stress that is related to IVF and you can do it in a relaxed environment in the best way with your significant one, I think that's incredibly increasing the odds. Just also looking at that bigger picture is incredibly interesting. To go back on Laszlo's remark, the blue zones and things like that, it's an ecosystem. Eh? It's the entire environment that drives you to, you know, it's the community, because a big part of the blue zone is the social interaction you have with communities, the fact that you're not isolated and things like that. So I have some thoughts of that, but I think travel is escapism. It has always been like that. And we also get the sense that the further we are from the place we have our troubles, the better it is to let them go. And the thing that we see right now is that the world has become smaller. We also have closer access to spa and wellness facilities. We see saunas being integrated in some houses. It's very easy. So to really have an immersive experience, we need to travel further and farther away to really be immersed in that. So love to have a coffee with you, Laszlo, to talk about that and talk about the behavioral side on it. But it's a healthy trend, but I think it's also a trend that is not only for the wellness, but sometimes also for profiling ourselves amongst the community and Instagramming our way to fame. Right.
Thanks, Mo. The world is indeed becoming smaller, and we can indeed follow people online and see when and where they are traveling. Aline, I see online very often that you are traveling all around the world. The world is very small to you, right? You go to all sorts of conferences. How do you live this travel for yourself?
I love traveling. And so I travel a lot for work, but I always try to take advantage of those travels to discover the countries where I am. So I went to Saudi a few weeks ago when I went to visit the LAN exhibition that we discussed. It was really, really good. But for me, yeah, it was important to spend that day to discover the culture, the people there. It was great, really great country, very, very welcoming. But yeah, I think it's very important. And Mo, I agree with what you were saying, that we need to go farther away to experience those things, but travel. So I went to Bali just before the pandemic. As Krupa, you're going to do like a transformative trip just for myself. And it was fantastic experience. Like the yoga there, it's something it was my first experience with yoga. I didn't really do yoga before that. And there it's like, it's a culture. They live yoga. And I came back to Spain and I said, oh yeah, yeah. And I want to do yoga. And I looked for some teachers and it didn't work. Like they were doing things very fast. Like it was automatic. There was not that special thing that you can find in Bali, and I was like, I can't wait to go back. Like, Krupa, I'm very jealous that you're going to go there. I think that's what's very special, that what those places bring, no? But on the other side, what bothers me a bit about those like transformative travel is that I feel it has turned into a business. And Mo, you mentioned before me, maybe the vulnerability. And people, I think, put prices that are not always justified, the value that you get. So what I normally do, especially when I do travel for pleasure, like Bali or I did Iceland 2 years ago, I do the trip myself. So I plan the trip myself. And at the end, it's more economic. It suits me what I want to do. So I'd come back, transform, following my own needs, no? And then when we talk about more like the medical side that you mentioned, Christoph. So here in Spain, so we have a lot of that, you know, Spain, Barcelona, it's a very known city for IVF, for instance. And I think it's really good to have those packages that you were mentioning, like to make everything ready for the people. It's not an easy process to come here for IVF. I think people are very stressed. Agree with more like if you can be relaxed, it also increases the chances of success. For some people, there's also maybe a culture. So if you don't worry about that, I think it's really the best. On that side, what I'm always worried about is the customer service. If you go to a country, let's say you can go to Poland for your teeth, you can go to Turkey for cosmetic surgery. And if you have an issue, like, what do you do? Like, do you need to go back to the country? Like, can you get that customer service in your own country? Maybe your dentist will say, no, well, you didn't do it here. Like, I can't take care of it. Do you have to travel back there? So that would be a bit my concern around that medical tourism.
Yeah, interesting. I haven't thought about it indeed. Well, thank you for that discussion, and thank you for sharing with us your travel plans or your former travels. Now let's move to the next segment of the Healthusiasm podcast. Is it something, nothing, or everything? So every month, one of the panelists brings an idea, an innovation or evolution forward that sparked their Healthusiasm. The rest of the panel will then debate and share their opinion about it. Do they find it something, nothing, or everything? And this month, again, I'll be taking this topic. And it's about human enhancement. You may have seen him passing by in the media, a guy named Brian Johnson, the tech millionaire who is now focused on regaining his youth with a rigorous plan that involves a strict diet, medical procedures, and treatments, and which costs him about $2 million a year. Johnson employs a team of more than 30 doctors and health experts who monitor every bodily function. He's taken over 35,000 images of his bowels, blasts his pelvic floor with electromagnetic pulses, undergoes weekly acid peels and laser therapy, has fat injected into his face, takes 24 of supplements while being on a strict vegan diet, just to name a few. After 1 year, experts say that he may have already reduced his biological age with about 5 years. Now, obviously, this may sound ludicrous, weird, funny, maybe even confusing, but it is an evolution and it won't stop pretty easily. The recent boom in genetic engineering, AI-powered exoskeletons, brain implants, longevity treatments are pushing the frontier of redesigning ourselves to a new level. So the real question is, or the real question at least that we need to ask ourselves, is how do we move forward with this? Because it is coming anyway. What are the ethics here? What is the policy or the guidelines to have? Is it okay to use these technologies to help a patient? And then is it also okay to use these technologies to enhance a healthy human being? Healthy between brackets, of course. Well, it's a difficult dilemma, but here's the thing. Right now, human enhancement is not really part of medicine. So this means that the laws, the institutional requirements, conventions, ethical guidelines that apply to medicine, well, they won't necessarily apply to human enhancement. Now, the good news is that frameworks, guidelines, principles are being discussed and investigated. For example, the European Commission works on an ethical guideline called Siena, which has a purpose to align them with the fundamental principles of human rights. But next to that, there's also plenty of research being conducted to understand how people think about such dilemmas. And one such particular study came out last week. And the study was actually set up to understand the moral acceptability and willingness to use polygenic screening of embryos. Now, for the sake of time, I'll save you from an in-depth explanation and analysis of the results. I will take you straight to the clickbait title of an article. It reads, about 40% of Americans would test and choose IVF embryos that are expected to be smarter. To put this into a context, that's the same amount of Americans that would consider an electric vehicle for their next car purchase. What's more surprising is that about 28% of people would even consider genetic modification when having children. 28% may not be the majority yet. It may not be that much. But if you think about it, that means that one out of four children would be an enhanced human. Smarter, better, more beautiful, whatever. I think we need to think about the potential consequences of this. We are at the very beginning of this boom of human enhancement. So I'd love to hear from the panel. Is it something, nothing, or everything? Let me go straight to Mo, because I can imagine you love this type of thing, right? Mo, is it something, nothing, or everything to you?
It will become everything, I think. I think it will become everything. But, you know, screening embryos, what are they screening for? You know, which of the little IVF embryos floating in a dish stand the best chance of getting into a top college someday, you know? And then the question is, how relevant will college be? 1/3 of recent college grads are working at jobs that don't require a college education. Another big chunk of people work in a job unrelated to their field of study. So we also hear Elon Musk saying, you know, I don't need a college degree. I just screen them differently. So I think the desire to screen for cognitive aptitude is already obsolete, right? And what is intelligence? How will intelligence evolve? The Americans were all appalled when the Chinese person did a CRISPR, you know, to make sure that his baby wouldn't have the IVF gene, and now 28 of them are in favor of doing it. So I think it kind of brings the discussion about what is smart in the future, right? And what is that going to be? And what are you screening for? I'd rather have a screening for good parents, because if you have a smart kid and you're effed up as a parent, you'll still miss the ball there. It's the notion of control. It's the notion of control. It's the notion of enhancement. But I do think that in order to prevent some serious diseases, like we're already doing it for Downer, right? We're already doing it for Down syndrome. And I think it's about, you know, are these people able to live a qualitative life rather than focused on performance? So I think if we can eradicate unnecessary suffering and screen for that, that would really be helpful.
Great. So let's look for some enhancement of parental skills then.
Yeah, I think that would be good. I think parents underestimate, you know, how they invest in their kids and at the same time completely mess them up sometimes.
Laszlo, are you enhanced as a human?
Absolutely. Can't you see or hear? Absolutely, I am. No, you know, enhancement, you know, happens. It's not it's not like you're done and therefore nothing happens in the next 40 years. Evolvement, you know, the difference between development and improvement, for example, indicates that one is measured in quantitative measures, other one is measured in qualitative measures. And I'm more interested in the qualitative measures, less so in the quantitative measures. But the enhancement as such, is it going to be emotional intelligence, Mo? Or is it going to be just the standard intelligence? Is parenting part of the emotional intelligence? Or is it, for example, in your case, parenting is not even necessary, may I say, because then the person is going to be so fantastically orchestrated, so they're just going to look after it. Itself, I think, or themselves, or how I should say it nowadays, not obviously not himself or herself. So that's, you know, that's obsolete to have a parent in that sense. And I think that becomes very much like a robotic, very focused on a certain purpose sort of life. I'm more emotional in that sense. And I think the human beings should be emotional and should be able to relate to others. And I don't think that much of that can be modified. You need to learn it as such to relate to others around you and what it means to a person as such. You can be very focused in for a certain direction, a certain objective, but I think that will be a less enthusiastic and less purposeful life in that sense.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I mean, the example that I gave about Brian Johnson, he's 45 now and he wants to become 18 again physically, is one way of approaching human enhancement. But I love the way that you look at human enhancement should be about mental and should be about how you evolve as a person, just beyond the physical stuff as well. Aline, what's your thought on human enhancement? I mean, you're a digital health expert. You're involved with a lot of technology. I'm sure you've read about Brian Johnson. What's your thought on this? Is it something not for everything?
I think it's something, but I find it a bit scary, especially the fact that you can select like embryo, especially like based on the mental capability. So when I thought about that, for me, it was like feels like people are heading towards perfection. And I feel like that would be boring. Like, do I want to live in a society where everybody look the same? Or do I want to live in a society where everybody is like super smart? Yeah, I think what makes us special today as a society is like the difference, the specificity, the imperfection we each of us have. And then also I thought about the fact that if we have those people that can become, you select them as the like super smart people, I think that can create an even bigger gaps in society, because I can't imagine everybody having access to that. It means there will be super smart people on one end, and then normal people or less smart people on the other end. So I can see this having like a more negative effect. And I would, yeah, really be missing that surprise effect, that serendipity effect that we have today. Like, you know, when you're expecting a child, you wait till the last minute to know if it's a boy or girl. I think for those of you who have child, I guess it's something very, very special, no? So having everything planned like that, yeah, I'm not too sure. And then I will agree with Mo on the Ivy League school. If everybody's smart, like, what's the point of the school? Like, there will be too many candidates for the school. And then are we going to have, like, teachers smart enough to teach those first generation of smart people? So that was my take.
Lovely. And you mentioned the gap in society. I have a gut feeling that is what Krupa would be mentioning as well, right?
Yeah, I was thinking about, are we going to have a certain population that has access to more advanced treatments than the other half of the population? I don't know. I read this, the article. I think human enhancement is coming. It's something. But at what point do you begin taking advantage of the person who is going through the process? At what point are you assessing them to make sure that it's still ethical to go ahead with what they want? There's so many things around it. And intelligence isn't everything. You know, we just talked about blue zones. Well, actually, if you look at what makes them thrive, it's community. So if you've just got people who are intelligent, you know, what about what's going on with their sense of community or social skills? Just screening on one thing, I wouldn't advocate for that. But I read this article and I have to say it made me very cross and it made me really, really angry on it, because it's a bunch of imagine if, you know, they surveyed the national population or they said it's a representative sample. But those people aren't the ones who may be going through IVF necessarily. So you can't actually say what you would do unless you're in that given situation. It's so hypothetical. And for me, if you ask people if they're going through IVF, would you like to screen on intelligence? I think it would be pretty low down the list. What they would be wanting to know is, are they going to have a happy, healthy baby that is able to lead a good quality of life? I just feel that this study, if I could pick it up and put it in the bin, I would put it in the bin, because I feel like that was actually nothing. So I felt quite strongly on it. I do feel that human enhancement is coming. Mo, I can see you nodding along, and I think you had something. Did you have something to say there?
Yeah, we're looking at the radical part of human enhancement. But if you look at how a medicine now is used for beauty, you know, Botox, for instance, right? It is a granular inflection of how we use it for enhancement. If you look at rugby players 20 years ago and the way they look now, their body mass today, right? We see it in performance sports, right? So we are appalled by the dystopian vision of that. But in the meantime, it's granularly getting there, right? So it is a trend that will happen. I think, as Christophe said, you know, as with new trends, ethics will lag based on where the market is, where the opportunity is. If I look at how youngsters for the moment are developing the body culture today, you know, being beachable and things like that, they're willing to go really far to do that. And in some sports, it's even leveling the play field. In some sports, body enhancing drugs are allowed, because otherwise you kind of have a play field of those who play and those who don't. So yes, I am appalled by the dystopian part. But on the other hand, if we look at it today, there are already, you know, a lot of things happening on body enhancement. And I think what's strange is we are trying to replicate the virtual visualization. It started with avatars, it started with filters and things like that. And we're having a problem telling them apart. When you have a filter, you look really great, and then you see yourself without the filter, and then you try to replicate the filter. So I think, if we're really honest, it's already there, right? And I don't think it will be stopped. That's why I said I think it's something now, but I think it will be everything in the future.
Thank you, everyone. It is clearly something, and as Mo said, it is definitely happening already. It's creeping in our society. But now time for something else. Normally what we do the fourth team is an inside out, outside in. But this time around, we do it slightly different. Krupa, you brought forward the idea or something that is happening early March, and you wanted to share it with us and have a debate on something very specific. Floor is yours.
Thank you. So 8th of March this year is International Women's Day. And the theme of this year is on embracing equity. So the term equality and equity often get used interchangeably. So if we just think about what the definitions actually are. So equality means that each individual or group of people is given the same resources or opportunities. Equity, on the other hand, recognizes that each person has different circumstances and allocates the exact resources and opportunities they need to reach that equal outcome. So basically, it's about giving everyone what they need to be successful, as opposed to everyone having the same thing. What we already know is that people don't begin life in the same place, and that there are certain circumstances that make it more difficult for some people to achieve the same goals. Those people are often from marginalized communities, for example. They could be people of color, disabled people, and women have also been disadvantaged over the years. And the goal now is to remove those barriers so everybody can thrive, so everybody can reach their own levels of liberation. But even within gender, it's intersectional. So a policy designed for some women may not also work for all women. And those, or those from marginalized communities, or those women who may be disabled. And the goal here is to change those systematic and structural barriers that get in the way of people from thriving. So one example here we've got in the UK, a UK study from the ONS, so Office of National Stats, has found that women who come from more deprived areas spend over 19 years in poorer health than those the least deprived areas. So embracing equity is the theme for this year's International Women's Day. And I thought it'd be really good to get your feedback on how you see this applying to health. So I'll start with Laszlo.
I think it's not just the International Women's Day that's important. And in that sense, it's a great moment to talk about this because you need to give the tools and opportunities for everyone. You can call it hyper-personalization if you want it in health. That you would have access to the right solution, not just to the solutions in general, but the right solutions that are relevant to you or the most useful for you. What I have been doing in the last year or so, and then you may say that that's not necessarily related to the International Women's Day, but I think actually it very much does so, is the looking at of wellness of men and wellness for men. And that has been overlooked, at least based on where we are standing, and also the 20-plus experts from all around the world, we decided that we want to do something about that. So talking about equality as well as equity, but for men in the field of wellness. And the study that we did is an exploratory survey with men from over 40 countries. And yes, it is just from men. But don't worry, the wellness of women and wellness for women is going to start as soon as we close this one. So it's, we understand the equal opportunity here. But we really need to highlight that men would need to take care of their being and well-being way more than they have been doing so far. Krupa, you used this example of the HIV testing that has been sent to your home and no one would know what you are doing. That's partially part of it. And we need to understand the landscape of how men look at their own well-being and what they believe should be done to make that better. And we are in the final assessment of the data. And it's amazing, and this is when the women come in, or partners more like, the number one source for any wellness-related information is the partner. And whoever the partner is, obviously, because we need to remember that the same-sex relationships, there is no woman as such. But the partner, not the blogs, not the websites, not the various other social media platforms, but the partner. And to most men, that would be the women. And since they're way more equipped with information and experience in at least some of the wellness-related aspects. I think this is how I relate to the wellness, or to the Women's Day, that their role could be magnified and say that you have your own opportunity here to improve your partner's well-being.
Thank you, Laszlo. Very interesting there. Christoph, it'd be good to get your thoughts on embracing equity, but also the feedback from Laszlo on his study and also the role of, say, women.
In general, I think, as you mentioned earlier, I mean, health equity is attained when everyone can attain their full potential for health and well-being, right? This is also literally the definition of WHO that I'm reading right now. And so indeed, I mean, it could be focused on women, it could be focused on men, it could be focused on any type of population, let's say. Now, I tend to look at it from a very positive point of view. I know there's a lot to be done still. I'm 100% sure we're not there yet. But I tend to believe that we are in a better situation than ever before. I'm just not the person that focuses on the negative, mainly because if you focus on the negative, what you focus on tends to grow, right? So that's why I really focus on what is already happening today. Besides, that's also exactly why I call, or that I invented the word healthusiasm, is because healthusiasm is exactly that. It's the positive outlook. It's the focus on all the good things that are already happening and trying to amplify all those good things. And so, if I work with clients, and I thought about this because I really find it a difficult debate, this health equity, health equality discussion, because I mean, there's so much you can say. But when I thought about what I do with clients is that I always try to help to improve health equity. I always say that my job here is to make the world a little healthier and happier, one business strategy at a time. And the way that I do this, I try to work with clients and try to focus on the social determinants of health and happiness. I try to focus on the physical determinants like nature, building, the things that we put out there, the medical determinants, whether it's access or quality, but also individual determinants, biological determinants, the commercial determinants, the price setting, the advertisement, the products that we put on the market. So I always try to work with clients to impact the determinants that actually have an impact on our health and happiness. And what I see and what I'm really believing is that for each of these determinants, we have a ton of examples and a ton of micro trends that positively impact health equity. So that's why I look at it from a very positive point of view. And I think that the debate around health equity should amplify or focus a little bit more the positive things that are already happening to make sure that those things grow and not always put a light on all the things that are not done or achieved yet. Because basically, and this is the pitch, of course, this is basically what healthusiasm is all about, right? So,
yeah, definitely. And you may have seen on the catwalk, for example, there already you have people who are disabled. They were showing larger plus size models, for example. They have women who are pregnant, you know, on the catwalk. You have transgender individuals as well. And what that is doing is it's equity. It's allowing them to be the best version of themselves, but then, you know, in the way that works for them. And that's been something that has been seen on the catwalk recently.
Yeah. So you worked for Mattel, right?
I did.
Am I correct? Yeah. Yeah. So Barbie, did you see the recent things that Barbie did? I mean, they brought onto the market all sorts of new dolls who are actually also disabled, who are net gender neutral, who are different skin tones. So I think it's there's a lot happening everywhere that is empowering this health equity thing for sure.
Yeah, thank you. Aileen, good to get your thoughts on this.
I'm very much on health equity, more than you. So you talked before about difference between health equity and health equality. I'm more for equity than equality. I remember a few years ago, there was a woman at a conference in Germany. There was a prize that she won a prize for the best women in AI or something like that. And I saw her after the prize. She was like, well, that's nice, but like, I would prefer to receive like best in AI. Like, why women? That puts you in a category. So I think what we want is to be chosen for what we are, not because we are a woman or a man. So I think that's important, and we shouldn't. The same should work for men. You know, like I'm not a fan of Manel, like those panel that I made just of men, but I'm not a fan of women neither, like a panel with just women. I think we should have that interaction between the two, like having like we have here, right? Like bringing the male and the female opinion, bring something to the discussion, and brings value. And then when it comes to healthcare, I think in healthcare sector, we're pretty lucky to have a good equity. Like women have an important role. They've always have. If you think about nurses, like the majority are women. And to Laszlo's point, that's something I always think about when we talk about women's health. So this is a thriving area. It's been growing a lot. There's more and more solutions for women, supporting women in the different areas of their life. But what do we have for men's health? So, you know, I do a lot of conferences, organize conferences, scout for solutions, and I don't see many solutions for men's health. Laszlo, you mentioned that, like, I was talking to a friend urologist a few weeks ago. I'm like, so what solution do you have? What innovative solution do you have for men? He's like, well, nothing. So I think that's important to just not, it's important to focus on women. I agree. But men shouldn't be forgotten. And we should also, take care of them and to develop such solutions. Laszlo, you were saying that are really focused on the men's needs that are different than the women's needs.
Thanks, Eileen. I think here in the UK, for example, our women's investment is around 1-2% in new startup companies versus getting, for example, male investment, which is at around 95%. So it's an interesting debate. I think there should always be, you know, something for each community or each group, and so that nobody is left feeling left out. And therefore, it's all, for me, it is like you, it's more equity than equality. Mo, be good to hear from you.
I think the first thing we need to do is acknowledge the complexity of equity, right? It has different levels, as Christoph said. It's, first of all, internalized, you know, what are unequal beliefs that you have as an individual. It's interpersonal, how we behave from one another. It's collective, you know, social norms. It's systemic, it's institutional. So that's one thing. Secondly is, I do agree with Christoph and with Aline, if you focus on one thing, focusing on one thing helps to exclude all the other things sometimes, right? Third thing is, what is the propensity of biology? Caring and self-care for men is different than for women. We've known it, right? Women use healthcare services faster, easier, right, than men. So I think it starts with embracing the differences, and I'm not for equity or equality. I'm for fairness and fairness of opportunity. I think chasing equality of outcome is not healthy. I think we should chase equality of opportunity, because I do think that if one is over-supported, then at the end, they'll be require a certain level of performance. Let's talk about the business environment, right? I think we should work towards each individual having the same opportunity to achieve a certain result. But if you look at business outcomes, for instance, right, I think it's healthy. And I do believe that women are the stronger and the most smart leaders. I've experienced it myself. My mentors are women, as far as that's concerned. But they were pretty good at what they did. They were incredibly good at what they did, right? So we shouldn't exclude performance out of that. Because if we look at the market is fierce. It is not fair. So over fairness in support could be unhealthy. So I believe in equality of opportunity. I think I believe in embracing the differences and knowing and personalizing what it requires for someone to get there and to get the fair chances, because the propensity between the men and the women to achieve something will be completely different. But to look at the percentages of startup investments, I think less women want to be entrepreneurs, because you need to be crazy to be an entrepreneur. I think women are smarter for it, because they say, I'm not going to work 80 hours a week and give up everything just to get there, right? So maybe there's also a propensity there where women at a certain stage say, you know, that life is not for me. And those who want to do it, you know, will do it. And I think they need to have the real chances. So there is a kind of a smartness. If you really look at entrepreneur and what you need today to get there, you got to be out of your mind. You need to say no to everything, right? And put your life aside. And I think women are smarter for it. And they say, you know, work-life balance and so forth. Why is that important? Because the market is fierce. The market is not fair. So fairness in an unfair environment kind of creates a friction. And I know there'll be a lot of controversies there, but I believe in equality of opportunity. And I believe in universal fairness. And I think organizations should be fair to make sure that if people are willing to put the work into it, that they will support them in getting there, right? I don't think we need to create a support system where the effort is different. And I certainly do not want women to work harder for the same thing than men. But I think we need to start with equality of opportunity. Is that something you can live with, Krupa?
Oh, gosh, it feels like I'm bearing the brunt of this decision. Oh, I think fairer opportunities for all is where I would go. Not just men, women, but however you identify, you could be transgender, non-binary. And I truly believe for me, it's fairness of opportunity for everybody. So that is how I look at it. Yeah.
Yeah. If we elevate the discussion above gender, it's just fairness for everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having that discussion, everybody.
When I created this panel for this podcast at the very beginning, I had about 45 to 50 interviews to select the panel from. I didn't have any idea. I didn't have any focus. The only thing I wanted was smart people who were fun to work with. And it ended up to be a very diverse group of people from all over the world. There were different ethnic backgrounds even, and different interests and whatsoever. This is what the fairness is about. If there's an opportunity, anybody can grab it. Thank you for these discussions. Thank you for these smart words, everybody. I'd like to wrap up the Healthusiasm podcast for this month. Thank you for listening. If you like this show, don't forget to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. By the way, you can find us on the Shift Forward Health channel. It's a podcast channel of thought leaders who are actively designing and building the health and self-care business of tomorrow. For now, I'd like to thank our own thought leaders for their insights and Healthusiasm. Thank you, Aline Noiset, Krupa Sutar, and Mozuwina. But also thank you, Laszlo Putzko. My name is Christophe Choquet. We are the Healthusiasm panel, and we'd love to see you again next month for some more Healthusiasm. Ciao.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, please spread the word. Tell your colleagues to tune in for all the awesomeness, then leave a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This show is produced by Shift Forward Health, the channel for changemakers. Subscribe to Shift Forward Health on your favorite podcast app, and you'll be subscribed to our entire library of shows. See our full lineup at shiftforwardhealth.com. One subscription, all the podcasts you need, and it's all for free. And remember, we might have a lot of work to do in healthcare, but we'll get there faster together. Thanks again.